The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
So now it's my privilege to introduce Peter briefly. Peter's here at the invitation of Trevor Stiles, who resides in Perth. Trevor organises Peter's trips to Australia, so thank you, Trevor, for making the introduction. And it's been my privilege to get to know Peter a little bit over these last few days. Of course, you'll know of the Pollock family, perhaps more recently Peter's son Sean, the captain of South Africa. And in his heyday, Peter and his brother Graham ruled the cricket pitch in the 1960s before the team was sort of in isolation. Peter was a fast bowler. Today he's only sort of given 20-25 minutes to speak, and I gather normally you speak sort of 40-45 minutes, so today he's coming off a short run. Which you never did in your career, apparently.
No, it didn't work.
It'll work today. And so Peter was the Wisden Cricketer of the Year in 1969. He played every single possible test for his country between 62 and 70. So amazing cricketer. He's been a leader in business. And I found out just the other day that he's also run the Comrades Marathon 6 times. So in my books, that's a great achievement. And if you don't know what I'm talking about,
don't worry.
It actually improves our incentive.
Yeah, that's right. We'll finish banging our head against this wall afterwards. But, thank you very much, Peter, for being here with us, and we look forward very much to
thank you very much. Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I've just got 25 minutes, so let's get going. I need to tell you my story. You know, it was always my dream to be a Springbok. I wanted to be a Springbok. That's the big emblem and the symbol in South Africa of success. South Africa is a sport mad country. I wanted to be a Springbok cricketer. I wanted to go to England and beat England in England. I always thought the English thought they knew everything about cricket. Best beat them in England, then they can't complain about the umpires. So that was my dream. And in 1965, we did that. We went to England and we beat England in England. And it was start of 5 or 6 of the greatest years in South African cricket history. By 1970, the South African cricket side was number one in the world by a long way. It still is rated as one of the 5 or 6 greatest sides in the history of the game. Anyway, there was a problem, though. From a political point of view, we had apartheid. The storm clouds were brewing. We had a tour cancelled in the late 1960s. In 1970, we were due to tour England. There was an election, there was a change of government, and at the last minute our tour was cancelled. The 1970 tour of England was cancelled, and in this place, obviously from a financial and revenue point of view, they organised another tour. They had a World 11, and they invited 5 South Africans to play in the World 11, Eddie Barlow, Barry Richards, Mike Proctor, and my brother, and I. Now, when you live in a sports mad country, South Africa is supposed to be a Christian country too. 80% of South Africans are Christians. I don't know where we get that from. Obviously, it's hereditary. You're automatically born in South Africa and you become a Christian. But it is a sports mad country. And whether we want to believe it or not, we all have ego problems. And when you have success in you and adulation and that, you become a bit of a monster. You don't like to actually accept it, but that is the truth of you. So you're a big deal. You're a Springbok. Now you're in the World 11. I mean, the sky is the limit. They actually sent us business class tickets. And in those days, we used to travel in the back of the plane. We got upgraded to business class, and we enjoyed that. That's fantastic. We got to London. There was someone to meet us and take us through immigration. I mean, that's fantastic. You are someone special when you help through immigration. Outside, there was a special limo to meet us, and we really enjoyed that. You make like you're used to getting into special limo. and we were signed up at a beautiful 5-star hotel. We always used to stay at very good hotels, but 5-star. And, of course, we enjoyed that. But there was a problem we noticed from the transport point of view. We had all this lush organization, but for transport we were having to catch cabs and go in the underground. Now, you'd all agree that a guy in the World 11 shouldn't have to catch a cab. There should be a Jag or a Merc with a chauffeur. And we hadn't found the Jag or the Merc or the chauffeur. So we thought, well, we better go and get this organized. So we trooped off to the MCC, the headquarters at Lord's, and we went off to see, the secretary was a chap called Donald Carr. Interesting, we went to see Donald Carr about a car. And the five of us trooped in there, and Eddie Barlow, we let him go in first. The thickest skin always leads the parade. And we thanked, we know you know how to play your cards, right? And we said, Donald, thanks very much for the business class ticket and for the meeting us at the airport and the fancy hotel and all that. But there's a problem. You know, we haven't got any transport. And you know, when we brought this up, he looked at us as if we crawled out of a piece of cheese. Everything, but the cars just weren't on the list. But he felt actually quite sorry for us because he'd had two tours to South Africa. And you know, we go overboard for sports teams. We, as the home players, we also get a bit annoyed at that, at our own country, because we go overboard. We treat everyone who visits as gods. And he had had two tours of being treated like a god. So he really enjoyed that. And he also felt a little bit sympathetic. He felt, well, apartheid, whatever it was, and the great iniquity that it was, the cricketers didn't deserve to suffer the consequence. So he said, okay, I'll organize a car for you. And he did. It wasn't a Jag, a Merc. It didn't have a chauffeur. It wasn't even a new car. It was Austin. Some of you are old enough to remember the Austin. It wasn't even a big Austin. It was a little Austin. It was Austin A40. You remember that Austin?
Yeah.
You know, the car wasn't even big enough to accommodate our egos. That's how small. And you know, it's a huge problem. There you've got five guys in the World 11, all with huge egos. And cricket's a bulky game. You have those coffins where you carry all your kit. So you can imagine. It's a problem for these five guys. But we organized the problem. It was simply this, because we had no other options. We used to spin a coin. The deal was any trip 20 miles or less, and we'd all just pile in and go for it. But if it was more than 20 miles, we spun a coin. And by the process of elimination, the guy who lost out had to find another way from point A to point B. No problem in Britain. Lots of buses, trains, and all that sort of stuff. We also spun a coin for who was going to drive the car. You actually had to lose it. The toss to drive a car. The first guys chose to sit at the back, you know, just in case the wheels came off. Anyway, I'd had a great run up to the fourth test at Leeds. I hadn't had to drive the car once. I didn't even have to get an alternate. Leeds, the game finishes a bit early. We have to go down to Southport to play in a Freddie Truman benefit match. Now, everything in Britain, Britain's not a big place. It's up and down the M1 north-south. This was east-west over the Pennine Mountains, the backbone of Britain. And up goes the coin, horror of horrors, I've lost it. I've now got to find an alternative method of transport. I consult all the transport manuals. If I catch a bus, I've got to go via Liverpool and catch a connection, and the train is the same. And that's the hassle. In the World 11, you don't need hassles like that. Midnight, carrying all your kit. I had visions of having to thumb a lift, and I mean, that would have been totally infrared for a guy in the World 11. But fortunately, none of those things happened. Fortunately for me, I was very friendly with a chap called Ted Dexter. Now, those of you who might know something about cricket, he was one of the great cricketers that England ever produced. But the important part for the story wasn't his cricketing prowess, but the fact that his dad had made a lot of money. He was doing his best to spend it all, and we were doing our best to help him spend it. And everything he had was fancy. He had an MGB and an MGC. Those were fancy cars in those days. He had a Mini Cooper with big, fat tires. And he also had an aeroplane. It wasn't a Learjet, but he had this aeroplane, one engine, one propeller. The plane was in Leeds. He was also going to Southport. I've lost the toss, and he offers me a lift. Now, I'd been up and down the M1 with him in his car, 100, 110 miles an hour, but I'm not so keen to get in the airplane. And Eddie Barlow, he sees this, so he said, what's the problem? I said, no, I'm getting a plane with Ted Dexter. So he said, you know, it's such a short trip. Just check on two things. Number one, has the plane been serviced recently? And number two, does he have any brains? Because you need brains to fly. So I did a quick investigation, and the plane had been serviced there at Leeds. I checked on his qualification, he had the equivalent of the qualifications that I had, but he also had a fancy degree as well, which made him cleverer than me, so that's fine, he can fly. I've got my qualifications from the Gray in Port Elizabeth, so I can be the co-pilot. Another guy needs a lift. His name is Derek Murray. He's a West Indian. He was the wicketkeeper. He was the youngest member of our side. Very good wicketkeeper. Still a student. Most West Indians are very dark, and he was no exception. But I must tell you that when he arrived at the airport and saw the little plane, he went a whiter shade. Remember, he looked at the plane. He said, "Man," he said, "are we going to fly in that thing?" And I said, "Derek, I'm same with you. I'm not happy about it. But we haven't got too many options. Absolutely." So he gets in the back, and I get in the front, and we put the earphones on, and I'm obviously looking very professional. And we take off, and it's a beautiful August afternoon. There are no clouds in the sky, unusual for that part of the world, but it was beautiful. We're flying 18, 20,000 feet. I'm now the navigator. I'm looking out the window. We're flying by the M1, you know, just checking everything. And everything's hunky-dory, beautiful August afternoon, when all of a sudden, as I'm looking out the front, the engine starts to splutter. And then the propeller stops propelling. Now, being a very perceptive guy, at Gray, I realized instantly there was something wrong. And I passed this on to Ted Dix. I'm very happy to report. He, in fact, concurred. We had further confirmation in the cockpit. All sorts of sirens went off just to tell us that there was something wrong. Confirm it. Next thing, Dexter was on the radio putting through the Mayday calls. That's when you line up the fire engines and the ambulances, you're in for a crash landing. I remember two things though, under the circumstances. The first thing was I looked in the back seat, and this guy had changed colour completely. And I remember thinking to myself, what a great pity we didn't have the whole West Indian team. That was 1970. If they'd all turned white, the government would have let us play cricket. The other thing that I thought about was God's wonderful law of gravity. And maybe when I was at school, I didn't concentrate on some of these issues. But God has set up the system, and into the system he's put biblical principles, and they are absolute. They're absolutely like gravity. You can't pray against gravity because it works. It's always in there. So there are biblical principles. So there we are. The plane, we've lost power. We're heading down. We've got a white West Indian in the back. I'm the co-pilot. Now, obviously, I've got to help. We've got to find a place to land. I look out the window, and I see an awe-inspiring sight. They're in the Midlands up to the north. They farm on these meadows 400 meters by 400 meters square, sort of surrounded by gray walls that stand 5 foot high, 3 foot wide. Some of them are hedges, but from 18, 20,000 feet, it looks a bit like a checkerboard. And, you know, it's not the ideal place to land. And you don't have to be too smart to work that a lot out. And, you know, as I looked at that, I realized that it's lucky dip. It's lucky dip with my life. And, you know, I'm a Christian, and I've always thought in life that I can sort out most things. If you're a springbok, if you're a CEO, you have all the answers. But even springboks and CEOs know that under certain circumstances, it is beyond you. And this was one of those circumstances. So I thought, well, it's time to pray. I am the right guy to pray. I'm a Christian because I was born in South Africa. I'm born a Presbyterian. My granddad was moderator of the Presbyterian Church. I've spent my life in the church, so I am the right guy to pray. So I start praying. I pray fervently, but very silently. Why silently? Because springboks never pray out loud, just in case someone hears it. You know? And the problem is they don't want anyone else to know that they need some outside help. But very silently and very fervently, I cried out to God. And I do believe that God answered a prayer. Because I can just tell you the fact, we start to head down. I stand here as testimony to the fact that light planes do glide. I think Boeings do too. I'm not sure about helicopters. I think they fall out of the sky. Although some guy said to me, even helicopters under certain circumstances do glide. Anyway, I know that light planes do glide. And we started coming in. And just to cut a long story short, we're now at a few thousand feet. We've got all these walls lined up in front of us, rather like the 100-meter hurdles that you see on the television. Not as close, but you get the picture, all the walls. And then we've got over there the biggest sort of field, We're hoping to get there. We haven't got any power, but we're hoping to get there. And it's quite awesome as you look at this whole thing. And then as we're coming in, we think we're going to make it. At the last minute, we're faced by a row of high-tension cables. They proliferate in the area. You don't pick them up so easy from up there. Anyway, Ted Dexter manages to flip us over the top. Someone said, "Oh, we're supposed to go under the knife." But we went over the top. We came in, we missed the top of one of the walls. We plowed into the field, skidded 50, 60, 70 meters, and pulled up a meter and a half from a wall at the other end. So you can imagine, half a split second, either way, you've gone and forgotten. The plane, though they're obviously not designed to fly into walls, didn't catch a light. No one broke any bones. We were able to open the door. We got to a nearby farmhouse. Within an hour or two, the press had arrived and the TV cameras. It was front page news and all the tabloids. It was on the BBC, and they interviewed Ted Dexter. And he became something of a hero. For the next 2 years, he spent his time going from one aviation club to the next, collecting all sorts of citations. Me, I cried out to God. But, you know, after the crash, I never took 1 second out to even think about God or even contemplate on the fact that he might have answered a prayer. And arrogantly, I went on with my life. But one of the absolutes of that was I became a total neurotic in aeroplanes, not just in the little ones, in the big ones too. And it was very, very embarrassing. I was petrified. I used to sit there and take off and landing. I used to hold, the sweat literally poured down my forehead. I used to get big globules of sweat in the palms of my hand. And it's embarrassing when you're sitting in a business class seat and the air hostess knows who you are. He said, "Mr. Pollock, well, what's wrong?" You know, you can't tell her that you're scared. You have to say something like, "Well, just check the air conditioning." You know, my wife will tell you that 24 hours or 48 hours before an air flight, I was impossible to live with at home. Not that I wasn't under normal circumstances, but when aeroplanes were involved. And I lived with that for some 12 years. It was an absolute nightmare. And then 12 years later, something incredible happened in our household. We were Christians. I reckon that I was a better Christian than most. Granddad was moderate. I was born in a man. He christened me. You can't do better than being christened by the moderator of the Presbyterian Church in South Africa. I spent my life in the church until the age of 15. I think it was the age of 15 when my dad had a big argument with the pastor and we didn't have to go back to church anymore. And our cricket improved, I think, a little bit at that stage too. But I was a Presbyterian. My wife was an Anglican. And she used to say that it's a higher church than ours. And I went to a couple of Anglican services, understood even less than was going on. So it's obviously a higher church. The higher the church, the less you understand about what's going on. Anyway, we were Christians and I had very firm views on everything, particularly the modern trends in the church, happy clappies, all that sort of stuff, my favorite subject. My wife gets born again. She goes to a meeting and she gets born again. Now she knows what the old man thinks about these things. So it takes time for her to actually tell me. She finally picks on a mellow moment, perhaps I was a bit mellow, and she tells me that she's born again. Now I don't remember exactly how I responded, but I think I like congratulated her, like she's joining the country club or something like that. Because you see, us CEOs, us Springboks, we know what we know, and we know most things, and we understand most things too. And I realized that my wife was over the age of 40, and you know they get neurotic, they go through a change of life, and we understand that. You know, we're not allowed to spill it out too much, but we do understand that. And I just thought, well, you know, this is a changing process, and you know how patronizing we can be in the circumstance. I said, "Well, lovey, it's great that you found something in love. Go for it. I'm right behind you. I didn't tell her how far, but you know, I'm right behind you." Now, I'm not playing an away game here, because my wife, I mean, she's a long way away from me now, but she often used to travel with me, and she's heard the story many times, and she tells it herself. My wife was a nag deluxe. Nye, 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 nye. Now, I know they're not in Australia. I know if they are, you're not allowed to talk about them, but in South Africa, we talk about nags. Nye, 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 when we have. In fact, in her testimony, she maintains that her job in life was to keep me on the straight and narrow, and she used to do it with the nye, 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 nye. So much so that we even had an arrangement with the nye, nye, nye. CEO, multi-million company, I had to be, and the arrangement was simply this, a pretty liberal arrangement. I had to be home before 7 o'clock. You know how busy CEOs are and all that. And even when we're not busy, we're busy. You know, that type of thing. We've always got all these things. So the arrangement was simply this. I had to be home before 7 o'clock. Home before 7, no nye, nye, nye. After 7, nye, nye, nye. Obviously, the later, the worse the nye, nye, nye. And it was a week or so after her commitment. I'm heading home. I'm sitting in my fancy Merc driving home. I look at the watch. It's after 7. It's well after 7. I'm heading home for a nye, nye, nye. I deserve a nye, nye, nye. And I'm going slowly because no man ever speeds home for a nye, nye. And I get to the home. We've got a lovely home, a big driveway. And even as I drive down the driveway, I go slowly, get out of the car, languidly head towards the front door. Because I know, open the front door. No nye, nye, nye. And I look. I take a step back. Maybe I'm in the wrong house. But we're all so smart. You know, we work these things out. And I thought I'd try to analyze it all because we're great at analyzing. We come up with conclusions that are not nearly right, but we like a conclusion anyway. And we believe it. And I was trying to analyze how it worked, but I ultimately came to the conclusion that it was just a lucky strike. You know, 17 years of marriage at that stage, that was just a lucky strike. A couple of weeks later, back heading home again, later than the time before, again I'm thinking about the other response, and I'm still trying to come to some sort of theory, strategy in this whole thing. No, it's not. Anyway, I get home that night, open the front door, there she is again. Hi, nice to see you. Did you have a tough day? The kids are there. Hi, Dad, nice to see you. The supper's warm, the beer's cold. It's frightening. I live in a world that tells me that leopards don't change their spots. And here in my home, the spots are falling off my leopard. You know, I watched this. But you know, I knew what was going on. But I didn't want to receive it. I didn't want to hear it. I knew this was God. I knew it was for real. But we are so set in our ways and in our beliefs, there's no way that I wanted to accommodate this. In fact, I even went out of my way to make her annoyed. And you know, the more I tried to annoy her, the more love came out. And I wanted that's even more annoying. I remember at one stage saying to her, to my eldest son, Gavin, Sean is the baby in our family. I said to Gavin the one day, I said, Gav, have you noticed the change with Mom? He said, yeah. I know if I checked with the animals, they would have said the same thing. You know, something's happened, yeah. Finally, I said to her, I said, Lovey, what has happened to you? She said, I told you, the Lord Jesus, by his Spirit, indwells me. Now, I want to tell you, that's far too complicated for a springbok or a CEO to understand. But it is the bottom line. The bottom line is that when Jesus Christ comes into a life, that life changes. If there's no change, there's no Jesus. She was blind and now she can see. There was a change and there it was. I was being loved and honored in my home. Complete change. There's a whole, we look at marriage and we talk about love. And that. The Bible says respect your husband. There's a whole different dimension when it's for real. It's real by the Spirit of God. And that was in the house. Anyway, the one time my wife says to me, do I mind if she goes to church? And I know that if I'd said I did, she probably wouldn't have gone. I said, I'm going to go. The more you go, the sooner you'll work your way out of this passing phase. But I said, you leave the kids alone. You're not turning them into Bible punches and that something. You just leave them alone. And then I said something about Jesus. It wasn't too blasphemous. I said something about Jesus and she started to cry. When I say cry, she just tears started to run down her cheeks. And now in 17 years of marriage, I've never seen her cry in front of me. We had a very good relationship. Maybe she'd had reason to cry on her own, but she'd never cried in front of me. And as I said this, the tears... And you know, I was delivering a bit of a tirade there, and as I looked into her face, it just stopped me in my tracks. The tears. And she never said a word, but it was almost as if the tears said to me, "Peter, you can say anything you like about anyone, but don't you dare say anything about Jesus. My Jesus." She wasn't talking about the Jesus that I learnt about and read about at Sunday school. She wasn't talking about the Jesus who theoretically heads up Christianity. She was talking about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who had died very specially for her. She was talking about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who changes lives. And I want to tell you, that is very, very different. A few weeks go by, sitting in front of a TV set, one Sunday evening, my wife's now going to church. 6:15, she used to get a lift. 5:30, she used to go into the bedroom and start getting ready for her service. And she used to start getting happy. She used to sing, "Jesus, what a wonder you are." And you know, it is the name above every other name. We can talk glibly about God however you perceive him to be. But God has ordained that all authority is in the name of Jesus. It is the name above every other name. It's the thing that is recognizable in the true believer. And that name, it is when you're running away from that name. And I tell you, I was running away from that name. You can even run away from that name sitting in the church every week. But I was running away from this name. Anyway, sitting in front of the TV set, she's busy singing. 6:00, a few years back, one channel, Sunday nights, that's the night you're going to get some Christian program. One thing they had arrangement with people like me, if a Christian program was coming on SATV, they used to play funny Christian music first to warn us that it's coming, so we could turn the thing off. Anyway, the warning music had been slayed, and now we get the program. It's a half-hour discussion program, and the subject for the evening is the Happy Clappies. They didn't introduce it like that, but I'd been on the subject for a couple of months. It wasn't as brutal as that, but I recognized it. And they introduced the panel, and on the right-hand side is Reinhard Bonnke, very well-known evangelist. Next to him is a Roman Catholic priest. Bill Chalmers is the chairman. There's the atheist scientist. And then right on the left-hand side is the late Stephen Grenfell, a big walrus of a man, a very well-known personality in South Africa, a TV personality. An atheist, agnostic, all rolled up into one. Very anti-Christianity, very anti the happy clappies, and very vociferous. And he was given the right, and he launched it. For 10 minutes, he accused the presumptuous, self-righteous, and boom, 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 boom. And every sentence he uttered, he was just reiterating some of the things that I've been saying to my wife. And it's great to receive confirmation on television. You know, and what a boyke. I listened to him, and my wife was busy singing in the bedroom, and I thought, well, I'll sort her out. Lovey, come listen. And she was lovey in all circumstances. So Lovey come, and Lovey sits, and she listens to the stuff, and she's obviously not very impressed by what she hears. I keep silent for about 7 minutes, which was quite an achievement. And then after 7 minutes, I said to her, "Well, Lovey, you see, I've been telling you the same thing." I said, "Obviously, I'm a prophet in my own land, but that's your prerogative. You don't have to believe me. But here's on TV. TV's truth. Do you know that?" Obviously not impressed. Her lift arrives, 6:15. Off she goes. I'm now left in front of the TV set all on my own. This other guy, Grenfell, had dominated the first half. Now it's Reinhard Bonker's opportunity to respond. Bonker said afterwards that this guy really annoyed him. And he really hoped that the annoyance hadn't shown through as he was responding. But as he started to respond, the camera zoomed up to his face. I sat there watching. And it zoomed up to his face. I never heard a single word that he said. But as the camera zoomed up to him, his face just shone at me. And as I looked into the face of that man of God, I realized that what was shining out of him was exactly the same as was shining out of my wife. In that simple moment of revelation, I realized that the Lord Jesus is for real, and that he does indwell those who love him and those who serve him. In that simple moment of revelation, I realized that the gospel is for real. It's not about all the things that I've imagined it to be. I'm face to face with the truth. In the light of that, the camera now moves back to Stephen Grenfell. And as he's sitting in his chair, as I look at him, he just gets uglier and uglier. And then I have a vision. One minute he's sitting in the chair. The next minute he's not there anymore. And I'm sitting in his place. And by the power of the Holy Spirit, I look at myself sitting there. And I saw myself vividly like I was a pig sitting in the gutter, sitting in the muck and the mire, and having the audacity from down there to point upwards and condemn Jesus Christ, who I knew in that instant was for real. And then it was as if my whole life came before me. My late mom and dad, particularly mom, she liked to sit down and write out a CV of her two boys, and maybe my CV reads 3 or 4 impressive pages. But as I sat in front of that TV set, I realized that I could take 3 or 4 pages of CV, I could crumple it up, and I could throw it into a waste paper basket were I to stand before God. I want to tell you, it's a bit of a shaker when you're an executive director of a multi-million company. You're a president of this and you're a chairman of this. The family does well. You live in the best suburb in town. People look up to the family. You sit in front of the TV set. Anyone sitting next to you wouldn't have heard a word or seen a thing. But by the power of the Holy Spirit, you are challenged. You are in the process of trying to gain the world, something you will never ever do. But tragically, you're in the process of losing your soul. And then it was as if I was asked this question: what have you done with the things I gave you? You see, God is in the people business. He's always been in the people business. We associate him with all the nation business and all that. God is in the people business. He made people for fellowship with him. What have I done with the things he gave me? My wife and my 4 children. The program finished. I sat there stunned. A couple of hours culminated just before midnight. I went down to the bottom end of the garden and I gave my life to Jesus. And when I gave my life to Jesus, I didn't get any warm feelings or any bells ringing. But I did do something that I hadn't done for 25 years. I sobbed and I cried like a baby. And it wasn't just from up here. It was like from the pit of me, a combination of joy, release, indescribable but unforgettable. But I know that at the bottom end of the garden, when I said, Jesus, I know that you are the Son of God. And I said, I give my life to you. I gave my whole life to him. I gave up my independent right to myself. I didn't just take Jesus and pin him on to my CV. And I would never be the same again. I walked back into the house that night, at midnight, never, ever to be the same again. But you know, with the tears, when the tears dried up, one of the first things that came back to me was that air crash of 12 years earlier. And 12 years late, I sort of recognized that maybe God had answered a prayer. I didn't think much more of that. It was about a week later, one of my monthly chores as CLO was to go to Joburg for a corporate board meeting once a month. And I used to get in the business class seat, 7 o'clock flight, back at 7 o'clock in the evening. And it was about a week after my commitment. I went to the airport, got in my seat, was just getting ready to tense myself for the takeoff, when I realized that something incredible had happened to me. There was no more fear. There was no more neurosis. Today I'm the happiest chappie that can fly SAA, probably go in a light plane with Ted Dexter. But you know, obviously I've told that story many times. I've told it many times because it's part of the testimony. But it was about a week after that, I was just sitting in a plane. And I was saying, Lord, what was the significance of that air crash? And you know, it hit me just, boom. There I was, 1970. Ultimate of my cricket career, I was wallowing in the glory of all the World 11 stuff. Get up in a plane. I'm faced by death. What's the first thing I do? I cry out to God. God answers a prayer. God reveals himself to me. Not too many people survive air crash. I get out of the air crash. Forget it. Become a total neurotic for 12 years. And then I go down to the bottom end of the garden that night. Something very deep and profound happened, but oh so simple as well. You see, all my life I've known about God. At the bottom end of the garden that night, I changed knowing about God to knowing God. And there's a massive, massive difference between the two. I want to tell you, knowing about God is not going to make any difference to your life whatsoever. Jesus Christ died on the cross that you might know Him.
Thank you very, very much for that very, very moving talk. We've got it's about 15:15 where we usually break up, but I think what we'll do is we'll just extend for another 5 or 10 minutes. So let's have some questions, shall we? Anybody dare to ask a question after that? Stuart.
when Ted Heath throws out the box from touring England in 70, how did you feel? I mean, you got to play the world, but you must have been pretty annoyed that South Africa was being pushed out of the game.
You know, it was difficult because yes, it did affect us, no question. There were a lot of careers that it wasn't professional. So there was a big money factor. But by the same token, us cricketers, and you have two sections. I don't know how much you know about the South African society and what goes on. And I mean, it's not a glib one-liner. There's so many things that have happened in South Africa over there. There was also, with all of us, we had a problem with apartheid. We really did. So you couldn't be absolute on those things, because to us too, we would have to say that in the final analysis, so be it. If the cricketers have got to suffer, so be it. So, when there's anger and thing, the one thing we really need to understand, that anger is a giveaway for any one of us. Because it just shows you that the emphasis is terribly on you. It's a big I thing. It really is. When you are concerned about other people, you don't get angry so easily.
Question.
What changes in emphases did you put into place in your family when you moved from knowing about God to knowing God?
I didn't place the emphasis. It's the Lord that did it. In those early days, I once came home, I saw a book, I took the time for me to tell my wife that I got born again. And she was reading a book on inner healing, and I remember sneaking up to the book there one day, and I saw there were 60 words describing sun. And as I looked at those 60 words, it was the first time in my life I got 100%. And it shocked me. I actually phoned the counselor at the church, a woman by the name of Mayhouse, and I said, "Mate, if I've got to be with all these things to be a Christian, I can't do it." And she said to me, "Peter, what have you done?" She said, "Have you given your life to Jesus?" I said, "Yes, I have." And she just said to me, "Praise God." And then she said, "Peter, don't worry about those words." She said, "You just keep your eyes on Jesus." But what impressed me about those words, they were all inside words: hate, resentment, pride, jealousy, all those. And when I looked at those 60 words, I realized that that's the real me. That's the me God knows. Not the me that I presented to the world. That's the me Jesus Christ. And forgiveness. I thought I was a forgiving guy. Until when? The next argument. I remember in the early days, I used to go, I've met the Lord now. And I used to go, and there's little Sean, 8 years old, lying in his bed. And I'd go in there and I'd say, "Lord, how can you forgive me for what I haven't been? I've done nothing devastating to them. I've been what I thought a good father. But I just realized that I hadn't even touched science." And I'd look and I'd say, "Lord, how can you forgive me for what I haven't been to those children?" And yet I know that God, as he promises, has restored the years that the locust has eaten. He's given them back to me. And he hasn't made my wife and kids to suit me. He's opened my eyes to see them as a blessing. Now, all these things have been achieved. It's the Spirit of God in us that achieves it. We cannot achieve it. That is the great problem that we have. Because man still thinks that he can climb to God, that he can strive and make it to God by reading books and learning things. It is only a facilitating operation. Those things help. You can't get there outside the Spirit of God. That's what makes the difference.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.